And you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. Stay tuned for Writers on Writing. Welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before I go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. My guest today is Audrey Niffenegger. She is author of The Time Traveler's Wife, recently published in paperback by Harcourt. Audrey is a professor in the Interdisciplinary Books Arts MFA program at the Columbia College Chicago Center for Book and Paper Arts, where she teaches writing, letterpress printing, and fine edition book productions. A visual artist, she shows her artwork at Printworks Gallery in Chicago. The Time Traveler's Wife is her first novel. Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show. I love your book, and as do so many readers, obviously. Such an interesting, actually, story, romantic story of time travel that defies convention in that it's a literary novel. It's not sci-fi. It's not fantasy. Will you talk about it? Talk about how it came about.
How I came to write it?
Yeah.
Okay. I, for many, many years, have been making novel-length books that are primarily made of pictures. And one day in 1997, I was sitting at my drawing table working on one of these, when the phrase, the time traveler's wife, popped into my head, and I wrote it down on the drawing table, which is what I do with ideas. And initially I thought it might be one of these visual books, which are, for me, they're a lot like silent films. They consist of aquatints, with each one has a little bit of text. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that anything having to do with time travel was really going to be tough to represent in still images. Because to me, the first thing that you think of when you think of time travel is someone coming and going, you know, a certain amount of flux and so forth. And so I rapidly realized that it was going to either have to be film or a novel. And being pretty broke, I decided to write a novel. But I've always been interested in writing. I've always been writing, and so writing seemed like a very natural thing to do.
But had you written short stories or had considered yourself a writer before writing this?
I had written short stories. I considered myself to be a visual artist whose work involved writing and whose a lot of my influences are very literary.
Uh-huh.
And so to me there didn't seem to be a whole lot of separation. It wasn't a big jump to do this. I never intended to write anything so long. But the story just kind of took over, and by the time I was done, it was a 600-page manuscript.
And you pretty much kept it. You probably didn't. I'm looking at it right now. It's in paperback, trade paper. It's 534. Oh,
yeah.
No, actually, it's a little more than that. Let's see, before the permissions, before the acknowledgments. Yeah, it's about 536.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was this pretty much the draft? In terms of, did it begin with first date one, Saturday, October 26, 1991, Henry is 28, Claire is 20. Was that always the beginning?
No, I wrote the ending first.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, the very last two scenes are the very first thing that got written. And after that, I started jumping around. Like, I remember doing the scene where Claire loses her virginity quite early. That may have been the very next thing I wrote after the end. So it was completely piecemeal. It's a total jigsaw puzzle. It was also radically rearranged about three-quarters of the way in.
How so?
I initially had organized it thematically,
mm-hmm.
which is to say that, you know, a train of thought kind of proceeds along based on what's happening. But several people told me that was really too hard to follow. They just couldn't keep it together. And so I started to rearrange it according to Claire's timeline, which, of course, is also our timeline.
So getting back to what you said in terms of writing this piecemeal, did you pretty much collect scenes and then organize later, or did you have an idea, did you have any sort of plot or outline that you were hoping to follow?
I initially thought that I was going to be writing third person with an omniscient narrator, and I was going to have chapters, and that kind of went out the window at a certain point when I realized that I wanted to get closer, I wanted to get into the characters' heads, and I didn't want to be constrained by the idea of everything having to be a neat little chapter. And so it broke down into scenes, and Claire and Henry are each narrators because their stories are equally important.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we should summarize what the novel's about for people who haven't read it.
How about, yeah, why don't we without giving away kind of the ending?
Yeah, I mean, essentially this is a story about a young married couple. Their names are Claire and Henry DeTamble. They live in modern-day Chicago, and she's an artist, he's a librarian at the Newbery Library, and really everything's pretty ordinary for them, except for that Henry has a genetic defect that causes him to involuntarily time travel. And because his emotions have a lot to do with it, it's kind of related to epilepsy in the way that it affects him, he spends a certain amount of time traveling back to his wife's childhood, and so Claire meets Henry when she's 6, and he doesn't meet her until she's 20 and he's 28. So there's an immense amount of time flux going on in this book, but I've held very firmly to the rule that no one in the book can change anything. Henry going back in time can't alter anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that fact kind of leads to most of the things in the book that develop. I mean, these people are not above and beyond time. I mean, they're still subject to time. They just experience it in a slightly different way.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Audrey Niffenegger, author of The Time Traveler's Wife. How did you come up with Henry's genetic abnormality as being the reason he time travels? How did that come to you?
That was actually very natural. The early writing of this was happening in 1997, 1998, and it happened to coincide with the period when the government and Craig Venter's company, Celera, were competing to sequence the human genome. And genetics was in the news all the time. I mean, cures for genetic diseases and these discoveries they were making were just sort of constantly in front of me. And so it seemed very natural to say, this will be a genetic condition. This won't be... I really, really wanted him to have no control over it, for it to be something happening to him like a disease rather than him hopping in a machine and, dialing up
right
where he wanted to go. That would have completely ruined the entire plot. So.
Hmm. I read something that about the writing of this book, about you wanted to write a book about waiting.
Yes.
Will you talk about that? It was such a touching story.
Yeah. When you're drawing, you always have to think about negative space. I mean, just as much as the thing you're drawing, the space around it is really important. And I wanted, when I initially thought of this idea, I thought, wow, the time traveler's wife, it would not be so much fun to be the time traveler's wife because she would be the one who got to stay home and worry. And so I started to have this mental image of this woman who was very, very patient, but who was kind of getting the short end of the deal because she was the one who got to hear about the adventures afterward, but seldom got to actually have any of her own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started to think a lot about what it would be like to wait for somebody. And in thinking about this, I got to thinking about my maternal grandparents. My mother's parents were quite close to each other in age, but my grandfather died when my mom was 16, and my grandmother outlived him by about 30 years. And I, of course, never met my grandfather. And my grandmother never remarried, and she never dated or anything. And so I got to thinking about their story as kind of an example of people who have been separated in time. And I always really did have this sense that my grandmother was waiting for something. So that was one of the seeds of the story.
Hmm. Now, you say that you... the initial writing began in 1997, 1998, and it was published in hardcover by McAdam Cage in 2003. Talk about those 5 years. Did you put this through multiple drafts and then get closer to what it was, or did you know pretty much what it was going to be?
I had a basic understanding of what it would be. And my method of working is essentially to begin a scene and then keep working on that scene until I've more or less got it, and then kind of place it like a brick into the overall wall. So there never really was a first draft. There was never some overall thing that had to be gone over.
Mm-hmm.
It was more a process of, building this thing kind of scene by scene. And the scenes are somewhat modular, and so they can be moved. And so a big part of it was thinking about what the ultimate order of everything would be so that the reader so that there would be suspense, but that the reader wouldn't get completely confused.
Hmm. Go ahead.
The end result was that the very first part of the book is the last part that got written. So if people have the patience to read it twice, they get a lot more out of the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And the ending, I think you said earlier, the last couple of scenes were the first ones you wrote.
Yeah.
God, so moving. I don't want to talk about them because obviously it'll totally give it away, but just so moving. I am trying to imagine writing such scenes at the beginning. I mean, just the emotional content is all there. And were you emotional writing this story, or did it come in waves?
It somewhat came and went. There were times when I myself felt kind of sad in the writing of it. There's a letter that Henry writes to Claire toward the very end that I was feeling kind of weepy when I was writing that. But for the most part, I'm a little more cold-hearted than people are when they read it, because after all, they're my characters, and I've decided, what's going to happen to them.
How do you, in writing a romantic story and writing an emotional story, how do you prevent sentimentality from coming in, or the sorts of things that could turn it into, say, a romance or a, more of a fantasy? I mean, were you aware of, this is going to be a literary novel, and so these are the things I cannot do, or were you just kind of following your voice and the vision you had for it,
I was essentially writing to please myself. I don't read romance, and so I have only a dim awareness of the do's and don'ts of that genre.
Mm-hmm.
I do read science fiction, but I'm not as super knowledgeable about it as the people who are total science fiction fans. So I understood that I was crossing some kind of boundary between literary fiction and science fiction. I was very surprised, although I should have understood this, to find people asking me about the whole love story aspect of it.
Hmm.
To me, a love story seems to be well within the proper province of literature. Everybody from Jane Austen to I don't even know who has delved into that. And so to me, that really didn't seem to be straying at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been interesting because I've talked to a couple of authors who write romance, and they're like, oh, yeah, this is great. We love you.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me kind of nervous, actually. But, I think part of it is just you write to please yourself.
And yeah.
It was interesting trying to get an agent and get published, because people looked at the title and thought it was science fiction, and, I guess that's a no-no.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about selling it and getting an agent, but first, will you read to us?
Oh,
so,
sure.
So those of you out there who don't even know what we're talking about can get a wonderful taste of this book. And if you just tuned in, this is Writers on Writing, and I am with Audrey Niffenegger, author of The Time Traveler's Wife, recently out in paperback by Harcourt.
I'm going to read the very, very beginning. This is the prologue. And Claire and Henry are both first-person narrators, and so I'll tell you when I'm switching between the two. Claire. It's hard being left behind. I wait for Henry, not knowing where he is, wondering if he's okay. It's hard to be the one who stays. I keep myself busy. Time goes faster that way. I go to sleep alone and wake up alone. I take walks. I work until I'm tired. I watch the wind play with the trash that's been under the snow all winter. Everything seems simple until you think about it. Why is love intensified by absence? Long ago, men went to sea, and women waited for them, standing on the edge of the water, scanning the horizon for the tiny ship. Now I wait for Henry. He vanishes unwillingly, without warning, I wait for him. Each moment that I wait feels like a year, an eternity. Each moment is as slow and transparent as glass. Through each moment, I can see infinite moments lined up, waiting. Why has he gone where I cannot follow? Henry, how does it feel? How does it feel? Sometimes it feels as though your attention has wandered for just an instant. Then, with a start, you realize that the book you were holding, the red plaid cotton shirt with white buttons, the favorite black jeans and the maroon socks with an almost hole in one heel, the living room, the about-to-whistle tea kettle in the kitchen, all of these have vanished. You're standing, naked as a jaybird, up to your ankles in ice water in a ditch along an unidentified rural route. You wait a minute to see if maybe you'll just step back to your book, your apartment, etc. After about 5 minutes of swearing and shivering and hoping the hell you can just disappear, you start walking in any direction, which will eventually yield a farmhouse, where you have the option of stealing or explaining. Stealing will sometimes land you in jail, but explaining is more tedious and time-consuming and involves lying anyway, and also sometimes results in being hauled off to jail, so what the hell? Sometimes you feel as though you have stood up too quickly, even if you're lying in bed, half asleep. You hear blood rushing in your head, feel vertiginous falling sensations. Your hands and feet are tingling, and then they aren't there at all. You've mislocated yourself again. It only takes an instant. You have just enough time to try to hold on, to flail around, possibly damaging yourself or valuable possessions. And then you are skidding across the forest green carpeted hallway of a Motel 6 in Athens, Ohio at 4:16 a.m., Monday, August 6, 1981, and you hit your head on someone's door, causing this person, a Miss Tina Schulman from Philadelphia, to open this door and start screaming because there's a naked carpet-burned man passed out at her feet. You wake up in the county hospital concussed, with a policeman sitting outside your door listening to the Phillies game on a crackly transistor radio. Mercifully, you lapse back into unconsciousness and wake up again hours later in your own bed, with your wife leaning over you looking very worried. Sometimes you feel euphoric. Everything is sublime and has an aura, and suddenly you are intensely nauseated and then you're gone. You are throwing up on some suburban geraniums, or your father's tennis shoes, or your very own bathroom floor 3 days ago, or a wooden sidewalk in Oak Park, Illinois, circa 1903, or a tennis court on a fine autumn day in the 1950s, or your own naked feet in a wide variety of times and places. How does it feel? It feels exactly like one of those dreams in which you suddenly realize that you have to take a test you haven't studied for, and you aren't wearing any clothes, and you've left your wallet at home. When I'm out there, in time, I'm inverted, changed into a desperate version of myself. I become a thief, a vagrant, an animal who runs and hides. I startle old women and amaze children. I am a trick, an illusion of the highest order, so incredible that I am actually true. Is there a logic, a rule to all this coming and going, all this dislocation? Is there a way to stay put, to embrace the present with every cell? I don't know. There are clues. As with any disease, there are patterns, possibilities. Exhaustion, loud noises, stress, standing up suddenly, flashing light. Any of these can trigger an episode. But I can be reading the Sunday Times, coffee in hand and Claire dozing beside me on our bed, and suddenly I'm in 1976 watching my 13-year-old self mow my grandparents' lawn. Some of these episodes last only moments. It's like listening to a car radio that's having trouble holding on to a station. I find myself in crowds, audiences, mobs. Just as often, I am alone, in a field, house, car, on a beach, in a grammar school in the middle of the night. I fear finding myself in a prison cell, an elevator full of people, the middle of a highway. I appear from nowhere, naked. How can I explain? I have never been able to carry anything with me. No clothes, no money, no ID. I spend most of my sojourns acquiring clothing and trying to hide. Fortunately, I don't wear glasses. It's ironic, really. All my pleasures are homey ones, armchair splendor, the sedate excitements of domesticity. All I ask for are humble delights, a mystery novel in bed, the smell of Claire's long red-gold hair damp from washing, a postcard from a friend on vacation, cream dispersing into coffee, the softness of the skin under Claire's breasts, the symmetry of grocery bags sitting on the kitchen counter waiting to be unpacked. I love meandering through the stacks at the library after the patrons have gone home, lightly touching the spines of the books. These are the things that can pierce me with longing when I am displaced from them by time's whim. And Claire, always Claire. Claire in the morning, sleepy and crumple-faced. Claire with her arms plunging into the papermaking vat, pulling up the mold and shaking it so and so to meld the fibers. Claire reading, with her hair hanging over the back of the chair, massaging balm into her cracked red hands before bed. Claire's low voice is in my ear often. I hate to be where she's not, when she's not, and yet I'm always going, and she cannot follow.
Thank you so much. That was Audrey Niffenegger reading from The Time Traveler's Wife. What a moving prologue. Gosh. So this was this the last thing you wrote, did you say?
It's not the very last thing. The last things are the scenes with Kendrick, the doctor who's trying to help Henry stay in the present. I was putting it off for a long time because I thought they were going to be super technical and full of all this medical mumbo-jumbo, and then at the end I didn't even do that.
So lovely. Wonderful, wonderful prologue and book. Stay with us. We're going to take a short break and be back with more Audrey Niffenegger, The Time Traveler's Wife. Don't go anywhere. Stay here. We'll be back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here with Audrey Niffenegger, author of The Time Traveler's Wife, recently out by Harcourt in paperback, trade paperback. Hi, Audrey.
Howdy.
Wanted to talk to you about the tone as I was taking a little break here. I was thinking about the very quiet tone of the book and how it packs such an emotional punch all at the same time. Can you talk about that? I mean, I think voice is one of those things. We talk about it a lot on this show where it's, in a way, writers don't have control over it because it's you. And on the other hand, there are writers that change voice from book to book because they, you know, the book entails that or requires that. What about this for you? Was this something that, was this voice and tone you and it's just the way you had to write it, or were you looking for a certain something and had to go after it?
Once I imagined the characters, it was fairly natural to write in their voices. Henry is very close to my natural way of speaking. And for Claire, I wanted somebody who was a little more reserved and a little bit more inward, and so her passages tend to be a little bit more subdued. But, you know, the fun thing about this for me was writing dialogue, because these visual books that I have been doing for years never had any dialogue. And so it was just delightful. You know, it was almost like when the movies got sound. All of a sudden, everybody was singing and dancing.
Oh, that's funny. Well, in terms of the characters, a couple of things. The first is the names, Henry and Claire.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did they come in, and what did they mean for you?
They came very, very early and quite spontaneously. I don't even remember actually thinking up their names. It amused me later when I realized that Henry and Claire were the names of the people who ran Time magazine. Claire Booth Luce.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't why they're named what they're named. It's a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, names are very important. I mean, I really slave over them usually. And they conjure up very specific and concrete sorts of people. And with the new book, I'm just finishing a period where I've been really working hard to give all the characters their proper names. So I think I've got it at this point, but it took a while.
Interesting. Well, Jody Picoult is very much looking forward to your next book. I send out a weekly email to a few hundred people, and she's on the list. And as soon as I sent it out this morning, I heard back from her saying, "Tell Audrey hi, and her book was my favorite last year, and I'm just waiting to see what she has next for us."
Well, me too. I'm only on about page 50, so it's very much a roller coaster and an adventure, the new one. I don't think it will be very much like the last one, but we'll see. I mean, I tend to see each piece I do as radically different from the rest, and everybody else informs me that really they're all recognizable as mine, so.
I'm sure there's millions of people interested in what you're going to come up with next. Back to these characters, they're so authentic and so believable. Did you do anything like, create biographies for them, do bone structures, do any kind of extensive work on the characters themselves before you wrote, or again, was it more an organic process of the characters coming as you wrote the scenes?
It was more the latter. They really sort of sprang into being as they were being written. That scene where Claire loses her virginity was put in the book almost unchanged from the way that I wrote it. Way back in 1998, so they were very much themselves from the get-go. And what's really been sort of a revelation to me is simply to discover what so many writers have said, that your characters tend to develop a volition of their own. You know, soon they sort of start behaving in certain ways that you yourself didn't plan on. And to some extent, that kind of shaped the book. Originally, what I had in mind was something much, much darker. My natural inclination is just to kill everybody. So I realized after a while that these were nice, sensible people, and that, you know, that there was really no call to massacre them. So I didn't.
Oh, that's funny. So you have an inborn sense of drama, you know, which is, I think, it's difficult for writers to kill off their characters. Makes it difficult to create drama.
Yeah, that's my natural instinct, is that the story can't end until everyone is dead. So, you know, to actually leave characters like Alba in an unresolved state was a big achievement for me.
Interesting. Who are your influences? Who are your literary influences?
I'm very attracted to very polished sort of intellectual writers. I'm a big Henry James fan. I'm very fond of Richard Powers' writing. I think he's amazing. Donna Tartt really impresses me, and I really enjoyed The Secret History in particular. I'm very fond of Rilke, obviously. I mean, I use a lot of his poetry in the book. T.S. Eliot, mystery writers like Dorothy Sayers.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all people that I really love.
Were you reading, or will you read as you're writing? Or do you go through bouts of reading and then writing and then reading and then writing?
I tend to read all the time. And when I'm actually working on something, I tend to read things that are connected with the book. The new book is set in London near Highgate Cemetery, and so at the moment I'm reading a lot of stuff about London and about Victorian cemeteries and stuff like that. But I'm taking a break right now, and I'm indulging myself. I'm reading Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Oh, how are you liking it?
I really love it. It's not what I expected. She's done a really good job of imitating an actual early 19th century book. It has a lot of that sensibility, that kind of a little bit of that dryness, and kind of a, I don't know, the characters are, they remind me of Dickens, actually.
Interesting. Susanna Clarke is going to be on next week.
Oh,
so
well,
it's
cool.
Interesting that you brought her up. Yeah.
Tell her I was grieving on her book.
I do want to get into the selling aspect of this, but before we do, I wonder if you'd read again.
Sure.
And again, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Audrey Niffenegger, author of The Time Traveler's Wife, recently published by Harcourt.
Well, I was thinking of reading from first chapter. I'm looking for something kind of shortish. I'm not going to read the whole entire thing, but just part of it. Henry and Claire finally meet in the present, where neither of them are time traveling, when she's 20 and he's 28, and he's working as a librarian at the Newbery Library. And she doesn't know she's going to meet him, although she's known him since she was six. And so she's been sort of waiting and waiting to encounter him, but she doesn't know how it's going to happen. Anyway, so Claire's the narrator. And this is Saturday, October 26, 1991. Claire. The library is cool and smells like carpet cleaner, although all I can see is marble. I signed the visitor's log. Claire Abshire, 11:15. 10/26/91, Special Collections. I've never been in the Newbery Library before, and now that I've gotten past the dark, foreboding entrance, I'm excited. I have a sort of Christmas morning sense of the library as a big box full of beautiful books. The elevator is dimly lit, almost silent. I stop on the third floor and fill out an application for a reader's card, and then I go upstairs to Special Collections. My boot heels wrap the wooden floor. The room is quiet and crowded, full of solid, heavy tables piled with books and surrounded by readers. Chicago autumn morning light shines through the tall windows. I approach the desk and collect a stack of call slips. I'm writing a paper for an art history class. My research topic is the Kelmscott Press Chaucer. I look up the book itself and fill out a call slip for it, but I also want to read something about papermaking at Kelmscott. The catalog is confusing. I go back to the desk to ask for help. As I explain to the woman what I am trying to find, she glances over my shoulder at someone passing behind me. "Perhaps Mr. DeTamble can help you," she says. I turn, prepared to start explaining again, and find myself face to face with Henry. I'm speechless. Here is Henry, calm, clothed, younger than I've ever seen him. Henry is working at the Newberry Library, standing in front of me, in the present, here and now. I'm jubilant. Henry is looking at me patiently, uncertain but polite. Is there something I can help you with? He asks. Henry! I can barely refrain from throwing my arms around him. It's obvious that he's never seen me before in his life. Have we met? I'm sorry, I don't... Henry's glancing around us, worrying that readers and co-workers are noticing us, searching his memory, and realizing that some future self of his has met this radiantly happy girl standing in front of him. The last time I saw him, he was sucking my toes in the meadow. I try to explain. I'm Claire Abshire. I knew you when I was a little girl. I'm at a loss because I'm in love with a man who is standing before me with no memories of me at all. Everything's in the future for him. I want to laugh at the weirdness of the whole thing. I'm flooded with years of knowledge of Henry, while he's looking at me perplexed and fearful. Henry wearing my dad's old fishing trousers, patiently quizzing me on multiplication tables, French verbs, all the state capitals. Henry laughing at some peculiar lunch my 7-year-old self has brought to the meadow. Henry wearing a tuxedo, undoing the studs of his shirt with shaking hands on my 18th birthday. Here. Now. Come and have coffee with me or dinner or something. Surely he has to say yes. This Henry who loves me in the past and the future must love me now in some bat-squeak echo of other time. To my immense relief, he does say yes. We plan to meet tonight at a nearby Thai restaurant, all the while under the amazed gaze of the woman behind the desk. And I leave, forgetting about Kelmscott and Chaucer and floating down the marble stairs, through the lobby and out into the October Chicago sun. Running across the park, scattering small dogs and squirrels, whooping and rejoicing.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to Audrey Niffenegger read from The Time Traveler's Wife, published by Harcourt and Paper. I remember that scene very well. You know, it was so interesting, you know, the idea that this woman is in love with this guy who she's been with, but he can't remember her.
Yeah.
That was just a wonderful scene. Thank you for reading that.
Thank you.
Let's talk about selling this book. Did you go the traditional route, doing a query letter, approaching agents, or
sure what did. I don't have any special ins with anybody in the publishing world at that point.
So what happened?
I finished the manuscript in January of 2002, and I had been faithfully researching what you do with a big old manuscript when you have finished it, and so I started to send out query letters to agents. And at first I was sending them out in batches of three, and then I started to get these floods of rejection letters, so I started sending them out in batches of 10. But
how many batches did you send?
Well, I got rejected by a total of about 25 agents.
Really?
I never stopped to actually count because that was too depressing.
Right.
But at a certain point in the summer, I started to send it to independent publishers also because you can't really send stuff to Random House because they won't read it. They'll just
right.
send it back to you. And so I was approaching the smaller independent houses who actually look at the things they get sent. And more or less simultaneously got responses to my queries from both Joseph Riegel, who eventually became my agent, and Anika Streitfeld of McAdam Cage, who eventually became my editor.
Hmm.
They asked for the manuscript within a week of each other. And so I got all excited, and that was July, and then nothing happened until October. But, you know, I mean, I know perfectly well that everyone in publishing is up to their ears in manuscripts, so I wasn't too worried. But at any rate, at a certain point I got an email from Joe saying, don't do anything, I'm reading. And I was like, whoa, he's reading, okay. And during that period, Anika called up and said, hi, we want to buy it. And so then I had that delicious experience of, you know, being like, okay, you know, then something will happen. It will see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this period of ambiguity where we did things like auction the manuscript and so forth, but it ended up with McAdam Cage, and it was fantastic. I mean, I cannot possibly be happier with them. They really were fantastic.
What kept you going during the rejections that came in?
Egotism, arrogance.
Talk about that. Seriously.
You knew you had something. I've spent my entire life reading, and I was convinced that, you know, I mean, maybe I'm not, you know, Henry James, but I felt like it was pretty good and certainly publishable.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, sooner or later, I'll find someone in the publishing world who agrees. And so, fortunately for me, that turned out to be true. I mean, you know, I know perfectly well that there are very good books that languish, but I just, at a certain point, I just decided that I would just keep sending out my query letters until, I don't know, until I just ran out of addresses, you know.
Now, have you heard from or been in touch with any of the people, any of the agents who rejected it? Have you run into anyone?
Yeah, I have. I've run into several of them.
What do they say? Oh, shoot.
No. Generally speaking, I don't tell them that they rejected it.
Ah.
I've had a few of these encounters now. One of them was with a very well-known agent who came up to me and said, oh, my God, I love your book. It's so amazing. And she's going, yeah, I'm an agent. I never say this, but, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, you're being really nice. Therefore, I won't mention to you that you had this manuscript, you know, you had this query letter in your office and, you know, turned it down.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, this person had never seen it. I mean, it was some person who worked in the office.
Sure. They probably had a reader, and the reader said, nah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, somebody obviously looked at it and probably said, ah, that's science fiction or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know. But, yeah, it's happened several times now that I've had conversations with agents who are unaware that they rejected it.
Hmm. Were you surprised at the book's reception? I mean, it's just been a raging bestseller. It's been, you know, which for such a literary novel, it's just, the reception has been so excellent. Did you expect anything like this?
No, not at all. It's truly floored me. I was expecting this to become sort of a small cult novel, kind of along the lines of Geek Love by Catherine Dunn.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my favorite time travel novel is Time and Again by Jack Finney, and when I tell people about it, nobody seems to have ever heard of it.
Sure. Well, it was made into a movie, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
So it always perplexes me that people don't know of it, but it's quite wonderful and charming and lighthearted and well-written. And so I sort of hoped for that. That was my goal, to become something that people kind of told each other about and kind of passed around amongst themselves. And so the fact that so many people have taken it up really kind of blows my mind.
Mm.
I mean, I'm a visual artist, and I've been laboring in the very obscure world of artist books. And these visual novels that I make, I usually make an edition of 10.
Uh-huh.
Actually, one of the great side effects of this whole thing is that one of my visual novels is going to be published by Abrams.
Oh, when is this?
A year from now.
Mm-hmm.
So that is that's a recent development that I'm really super excited about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is it's going to be made into a movie.
Yes.
It's been optioned. I don't know. Is it in production at
this point? Things are looking good. There is a script by Jeremy Levin, and the people who optioned the rights, it's New Line Cinema, Nick Wexler, and Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston's production company, Plan B.
Mm-hmm.
And they are in the process of trying to hire a director. So things are bopping along.
Hmm. Now was that unexpected? Or when it started, you know, becoming just, you know, a well-read book, was it just like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, of course.
Well, the rights were optioned before the book was published. So they were actually taking a chance. It was not a sure thing for them at all. And I was very grateful, actually, that they took notice of it, because it helped people become aware of the book. Although it's sort of funny, you know, because Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston are like these sort of super celebrities that you see every time you go to the grocery store, their faces on magazines.
Yes.
To think that they've read the book, much less that they have, you know, that they may be in the movie is kind of interesting to me.
Gosh, we're just about at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any words of advice for the writers listening.
Mainly what everybody else must say to everyone, which is don't give up. But also agents are fabulous and invaluable, and my agent has been sort of a magician for me. But also to think about the independent publishing houses, because they take risks and they publish some astonishing stuff. I mean, not only as writers, but as readers, we should all be supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a handful of them out there. There's McAdam Cage, who published me, but there's also McSweeney's and Grey Wolf and Copper Canyon and so forth. I mean, they publish fantastic things.
Yeah, I think sometimes new writers especially think that they need one of the majors to make their book fly, when in fact a lot of the time it is the smaller publishers that have the energy or the interest to give you a push.
Yeah, the small publishers don't put out quite so many books, and so they pay attention to every one that they do put out. I mean, they don't put things out just to see if they'll fly.
Right.
And they really believe in what they're publishing, and so it's really kind of in some ways a good bet. I mean, McAdam Cage was partnering with Harcourt from the beginning. I mean, they knew that Harcourt was going to do the paperback, and so they received a lot of advice and assistance, and it was a really nice kind of best of both worlds thing.
Yeah. Oh, well, so excellent to have you on, and we'll look forward to your book in a year, and look forward to the movie and your next novel, and on and on.
Yeah, on and on.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It was Audrey Niffenegger, author of The Time Traveler's Wife, now out in trade paperback by Harcourt, and she spoke to us from Chicago. Yes, lovely book. And, you know, I'm an old record here. It's a skipping record where I say I love the cover, but I love the cover. It's I love Harcourt covers, and this is one more that is just beautiful, and the texture is wonderful, and all the things that I think matter to you as a writer, but as somebody who's going to shell out, you know, $15, $20, $25 for a book, you want to love it. You want to love looking at it and touching it, and this one is right there. All right, what else can I tell you? I want to tell you that if you want more info, you can go to my website at penonfire.com. Yes, it's a rather new website that goes along with my rather new book, Pen on Fire. It's now out, spotty in stores, but it's online. And penonfire.com, you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list, so that you learn that wonderful writers are coming on, such as Audrey, and next week it's Susanna Clark, who wrote Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell, and also the author of Full Bloom, the biography of Georgia O'Keeffe. They will both be on next week. And there's just so much news. I have to stop in a sec, but my book launch is going to happen October 7th at Book Soup in Costa Mesa, South Coast Plaza, in the evening. Also in October 3rd, backing up from the 7th, the West Hollywood Book Fair. A wonderful day of books in Hollywood, West Hollywood. Many authors, many panels. I believe it's no cost. It's the fourth year, perhaps, third or fourth year. I hope I got that right. And I will be there in an afternoon panel called Pen on Fire, Women Writers Igniting Their Pen, something like that, with Barbara Serinella and Gail Brandeis, excuse me, and a few others. So hope you can stop by and say hello. I am going to leave you now with a quote by J.B. Priestley, and it's from the beginning of The Time Traveler's Wife, and it goes like this. Clock time is our bank manager, tax collector, police inspector. This inner time is our wife. Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next time.